Power Records presents...
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of the Power Records podcast, where the action comes alive. I am your host, Rob Kelly, and with me, as always, is my co-host of the Supermates podcast, Chris Franklin. Chris, how you doing?
Damn it, Rob, I'm a graphic designer, not a podcaster.
I should have known something like that was coming, considering that for this episode, we will be talking about two audio adventures of Power Records featuring Star Trek. This was a big, big license that the Power Records Peter Pan people had, and we have not gotten around to it at this point, so we thought the time was right. But before we do that, we are going to thank our sponsor, InStock Trades. This episode of the Power Records podcast is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStock Trades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 45% off with free shipping of order for orders of $50 or more. One of the things available at InStockTrades.com right now is Star Trek Newspaper Strip Hardcover Volume 1. This was something I didn't even know existed. There was apparently a Star Trek newspaper strip. And it ran from the stories collected here ran from December 1979 to October 1981. Stories and art by Thomas Warkentin, I don't know who that is, Sharman Devono, and Ron Harris. This is published by IDW. It's a hardcover, black and white and color, 264 pages. The normal price is $49.99. InStock Trades price is $34.99. That's 30% off. I've never read any of these, so I have no idea whether they're any good or not. It was the Star Trek the Motion Picture era, so this was probably maybe not the best time to do a Star Trek newspaper strip.
Lots of pajamas.
Lots of people staring at screens and whatever. And you can see on the cover they're in their little pajama suits. But you know what? I'm intrigued as to see how this works. I might even give this a shot. So yeah, Star Trek the Newspaper Comics, 30% off, $34.99 on InStock Trades. Chris, what do you have?
I actually have Star Trek New Visions trade paperback. This is the first collection of the photo comics that John Byrne has been doing. It says John Byrne presents all new TOS episodes like you've never seen them before, including the 2013 photo novel annual Strange New Worlds, as well as the feature-length novels The Mirror Cracked and Time's Echo, done in an all-new Fumetti style by one of the greatest living comic book artists. The publisher is IDW, and it is normally $19.99. In-stock trades price is $13.99. That's 30% off. And I actually have a few of the individual comics of these, and I really enjoy them. Cindy and I actually did a Supermates episode on a couple of them. To me, they give you the Star Trek feel more than any comic I've read, partially because there's the actors right in front of you. But Byrne really, really captures he captures the feel of Star Trek, the voices. It just feels like Trek.
Yeah, these are things I think a lot of people don't even know exist.
Yeah, they're kind of under the radar, I think. And they're a little pricey when they come out. They're kind of what we used to call the prestige format, you know, they're square bound. I just picked up the new one a couple weeks ago, and actually I think it may, I don't know this for certain, but I'm pretty sure it's got a cameo by one of your friends, Rob. There's a guy that looks suspiciously like Paul Kupperberg in here.
Ah, that would, him and Byrne are buddies, so that would make a lot of sense.
Right, it looks like pictures I've seen of him, and he's playing a guy that the Enterprise pick up his message on their view screen. And I'm pretty sure it's him. So
I will have to check that out now. I'll have to ask Paul about it. So yeah. Very cool suggestion. He said, for these and all your other trade paperback needs, please visit InStockTrades.com. And we thank them for their support. So as I mentioned at the top of the show, we are going to be talking about two Star Trek audio adventures this time around, A Mirror for Futility and The Time Stealer. Star Trek was one of Power Records' biggest licenses. They did a whole bunch of these adventures spread out over many, many different releases, 45s, book and record sets, LPs. They really were one of the bigger licenses. So we're going to get right to it. This first adventure, as I mentioned, is called A Mirror for Futility.
Captain's log, stardate 5470. The Enterprise is on routine patrol on the outer fringes of Federation territory, facing the intergalactic Gulf. We are preparing to terminate the patrol. Nothing unusual has been encountered. Log concluded.
Captain?
What is it, Mr. Sulu?
I'm picking up all kinds of powerful radiation at extreme detector range.
What kind of radiations, Lieutenant?
I don't know, sir. Some of it's identifiable, and the rest resembles nothing I've ever seen before in my readouts. Check them yourself.
Lieutenant Sulu is quite correct, Captain. The concentration of violent energies is extraordinarily intense. It resembles no natural phenomenon.
Heading, Mr. Sulu?
308, 6 degrees, 000. Range?
Range, Mr. Sulu.
Closing, Captain, but the disturbances are so violent, I can't say for certain. Two centers, possibly more, are involved.
Very well. Change course to intercept. Lieutenant Uhura, sound yellow alert.
Aye, Captain.
Bridge to engineering.
Engineering, Scott here, Captain.
Scotty, we're heading for a violent energy disturbance of as yet unidentified origins. We may have to do some jumping about. Stand by.
Ready back here, sir.
Good. Bridge out.
Range is still considerable, sir.
Full power on the long-range sensors, Mr. Sulu. Wide screen if possible.
Working on it, sir. We're getting something. What the?
Most remarkable.
What is it? I've never seen a ship like that before.
Or of that size.
What have you got, Mr. Spock?
There are two ships, Captain. They are apparently engaged in combat with one another, employing numerous weapons I cannot begin to describe. The forces involved? Each ship is putting out more destructive energy than 100 ships the class of the Enterprise. Yet both ships, while badly scarred, appeared to be intact. Each is at least 60 times our mass.
Captain?
Yes, Uhura.
Sir, both ships are broadcasting on several frequencies. I can't decipher what they're saying. The universal translator doesn't recognize either language. The words are apparently directed at each other.
Put it on the speakers, Lieutenant.
Yes, sir.
Lower the volume, but keep it on the speakers, Lieutenant. Mr. Spock, how are you coming with identification?
Nothing in records yet, Captain. Still processing.
Intruder, identify thyself.
Laura, give me a reply frequency.
Ready, Captain.
This is Captain James T. Kirk of the USS Enterprise. Who are you? Where do you come from?
What dost thou represent?
The United Federation of Planets and its allied peoples. I repeat, who are you?
I am the Red Worm, 333rd Super Dreadnought of my class, built by the Unified Dray peoples. There is nothing in my computer banks of a United Federation. Therefore, I must assume you are unneutral.
For God's sake, Jim, confirm that we are neutral.
It has been assumed, Doctor. Didn't you hear?
Yes, but I don't want that thing to forget it. That's the biggest warship I ever saw. Except for the one it's fighting, of course.
What ship? What ship? Identify yourself immediately!
Uhura, did we just do that?
This is a different frequency, Captain. The call is coming from the other ship.
Hmm. This is James Kirk, commanding the USS Enterprise, United Federation of Planets. We are... neutral.
Impossible! I, renderer of the Nex Empire, have declared that all who are not allied with me are friends of the unmentionable Dray peoples!
Sorry, but we really are neutral. We have nothing to do with either the Dray peoples, as you call them, or the Nex Empire. Spock, what have you got on those two stellar civilizations? I've never heard of either of them.
Working on it, Captain.
You must listen to me, or if you...
I call on you to surrender your...
Signals have faded out, Captain. They appear to have forgotten us already. They're fully occupied trying to destroy each other.
And I have information on both groups.
What is it, Spock? Where are they?
They are no longer anywhere, Captain. According to mythological records, both races have been extinct in our galaxy for over 150,000 years.
And know thou that I shall fight for another 150,000 or 150 million until the last remaining vestige of the blasphemous Nax are eliminated from existence.
Where are your officers? Who am I speaking to? Which member of the crew?
Crew? Officers? We of the Nax carry on for our builders and masters!
No less we of the Dray, infidel.
What do you make of that, Mr. Spock?
I think there can be no doubt, Captain, as there is nothing in the records to indicate that either race was immortal.
we must surmise that the crews of both ships have been dead for at least 150 millennia, and the war has been carried on all this time by the computer minds of these two ships.
Incredible!
Well put, Doctor. Both ships have apparently survived on their own initiative, continuing to carry out the last orders of their living masters, repairing themselves, modifying their own structure, constantly developing new weapons and new defenses, each hunting for a crucial advantage over its opponent. Yet it seems they are evenly matched.
All very interesting, Mr. Spock, but at the moment I'm more concerned about their present course. If they keep traveling in the direction they are now, they'll enter densely populated Federation space within a few days. They've elected to regard us as neutral, for now. They may not treat other Federation shipping, or Federation worlds, so politely. Uhura, give me dual broadcast frequency for both vessels.
Ready, sir.
Enterprise to combatants. Enterprise calling combatants. Listen, you two. You can reduce each other to mesons if you want. But can't you do it somewhere else? You are headed...
A challenge! You would dispute my position?
No, no. Forget what I said. Spock, what are we going to do? These two are so involved with each other, they've lost the ability to trust anyone else. But we have to turn them somehow.
Maybe if we could discover the reason behind the fighting, we could mediate for them, Jim.
Didn't you hear the insults they threw at each other, Bones?
After 150,000 years, Doctor, I doubt that either ship recalls what the war was originally fought over. That's usually the case with most wars which last more than a few months.
Still, we have to do something. Jim, how about taking sides, joining up to help one ship defeat the other?
Too risky, Bones. We know nothing of either the Drey peoples or the Nax Empire. I can't opt for one side blind. Besides, I doubt that the Enterprise would make one bit of difference for either side, considering the kind of energy weapons they're using. I doubt that our phasers and photon torpedoes could so much as irritate either vessel. And it could get the Enterprise blown clear to the Magellanic clouds.
Just the Enterprise, maybe. But suppose we convince them we can call on several thousand ships the size of the Enterprise.
A thought, Doctor. Except that we cannot call on several thousand ships. We cannot even call immediately on three or four.
True, Spock. But they don't know that.
It's worth a try, Bones. Uhura, sound red alert. To the Red Worm of the Drey peoples. Unless you change your course, you will soon be set upon by thousands of warships of the United Federation of Peoples and will be destroyed. And Renderer of the Nax Empire, unless you break off and disengage from this sector, 10,000 cruisers of the UFP will appear to volatilize the last remnant of your empire.
Sacrilegious interloper!
Enemy of its Imperial Majesty! I have been deceived!
Captain, both ships are changing course.
Mr. Sulu! Emergency overdrive, warp 8.
That was close, Captain. They both fired at our former position.
With their minor batteries, I reckon. However, they regard the threat seriously, it seems. Both vessels are currently in pursuit.
Sulu?
They're not closing, Captain. They're still too busy fighting each other, but we're not pulling away from them either.
Good. I don't want to lose them. Yes. Kirk here. Go ahead, Mr. Scott.
Captain, how long are we going to run at warp 8? We've got full deflector shields up, too. We cannot maintain this kind of shielding and this speed for too long.
I know, Scotty. Hang together down there a while longer yet.
We'll do what we can, Captain. Scott out.
Well, Bones, we got them to change their course. We're headed away from Federation-inhabited worlds now. That still leaves the problem of convincing them to leave us alone.
Well, I don't know what to suggest, Jim. I didn't get that far.
Great. Mr. Spock?
I don't know what to suggest either, Captain. At this point, the crucial issue appears to be whether or not...
A trick! I see through you now. There is no such thing as a United Federation of Planets. It was a low ploy of you, blasphemer, to attempt to fool me into assuming a weaker tactical position.
You are quick, quick, evil monster! Did you truly think to trick me, with such a feeble lie? This United Federation, this tiny fabrication masquerading as an inhabited ship, is but a decoy, manufactured in your own perverted factories. You will pay for that. Die, social misfit!
I shall extinguish your noisomeness, Imperial vileness.
They're slowing, Captain. We're pulling clear of them.
Of course, Mr. Sulu.
Unchanged. They're still headed full speed away from Federation space.
Well, what do you think of that? Did you hear, Jim? They've decided that the Enterprise is a trick. The Red Worm thinks we're a trick of the renderer, and the renderer believes we're a decoy cooked up by the Red Worm.
Each computer has been battling the other for so long, they can no longer trust anything. It is so in all extended wars. Truth is the first casualty, and the last wound to heal.
Mr. Sulu, set in a course for Starbase 14.
Aye, sir. Detectors report both ships still heading out toward the galactic rim.
And according to sensors, still fighting with each other as heavily as ever. It is sad, Captain. All that knowledge, all that power, devoted to continuing a war whose cause has long since been forgotten.
What a waste. Sulu, reduce speed to warp factor 5.
There's one thing that bothers me, though, Captain.
What's that, Lieutenant?
What happens if one ship, either the Red Worm or the Renderer, finally does win? Won't it start hunting for someone else to fight? We threatened them both in the name of the Federation. Won't the winner come looking for us?
I wouldn't worry, Lieutenant O'Hara. Both vessels have been in a state of constant warfare for 150,000 of our years without either side gaining a lethal advantage. I think it's safe to say that they will continue to remain evenly matched for another 150,000 years.
Let's hope so, Mr. Spock. Let's hope so.
And that was A Mirror for Futility. I have to say, Chris, I'm sure you're in agreement with me, that is a very Star Trek-y adventure.
Oh, yeah. I mean, those guys managed to capture in, what is it, like 12 minutes? They managed to capture Star Trek in Gold Key, never did in like 13 years of comic book footage. So even if you don't look at the comic book that came with the album, the audio alone is it definitely feels like that could be an episode of Star Trek. I mean, no problem.
Yeah, the plot is just it is very, very, and it's kind of amazing when you listen to it. And as you said, it's only like 11 or 12 minutes. It feels pretty complete, mm-hmm. A pretty complete story. And yet, you know, a typical Star Trek episode was, you know, what, minus commercials, 42 minutes, 45 minutes
at least. Yeah,
and this is 11 minutes flat. You know,
yeah, they skipped all the dramatic pauses and just.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah,
and just went for it. Yeah, I mean, the it's a morality play, and the lesson, the moral of the story, of course, war is bad and futile, and but you know, it's not real subtle. But a lot of times, Star Trek wasn't real subtle.
Yeah, no, Star Trek was not known for its subtlety.
You're so. Black on the left side, and you're black on the right side, and you hate each other. You know, so. Yeah. but yeah, it really does. I mean, I had a couple of Star Trek power records as a kid, and they've got the motion picture outfits on in the comics, and so it came out in that era, and the pajamas, like we said, and they weren't nearly as good as this one. This one feels a lot more like Star Trek.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of that has to do with the voice acting. I mean, I think the voice actors almost uniformly for the Star Trek records were really good. I mean, I don't know the credit. I don't, much like all the other power records we've talked about, I don't know the credits for any of these people, any of these actors. But the guy playing Kirk is doing, he's doing Shatner, but he's not imitating Shatner, kind of, if that makes any sense. It's sort of like, I thought it was similar to what Chris Pine did in the J.J. Abrams movies, that he's doing Shatner as Kirk, but he's not he's not just mimicking him either.
Kevin Pollak doing shit.
Right, yeah, yeah.
He's not talking every other line like this.
Yeah, I mean? Yeah, right.
Of course, that was kind of before that became a thing. I mean, I was thinking about that because around the time these were being made, maybe the Saturday Night Live skit had aired, which I think Belushi did that a little bit, but that was before the, you know, people picked up on that as the instant Shatner, you know, the way to mimic him. But yeah, the voices in this, the only actor that seems like they're really kind of really, you know, that they're kind of, and they still pull it off is really trying to mimic is Bones. Right. And there's a couple times where they really seem like they're trying to do Bones at his, you know, grumpiest. But they all feel right with just a few minutes. You accept them as the characters. And that helps sell the story as well as the fact that, like we said, it the plot, the even the nomenclature, the United Federations of Planets, and all the Star Trek terms are used properly. The only thing that kind of brings it down is if you have the comic, then yeah. You notice that Sulu is suddenly black and Uhura is suddenly white.
Yeah. And it's clear if you look at them that whoever did the art, and some panels seemed to be done by Neil Adams, others not so much, they clearly had photo reference, because there were some panels that are Shatner, that are entirely Shatner. And yet, then you've got, like you said, you've got a white blonde Uhura. so it's like, what, did they only get some photos of the cast? I mean, it didn't make a whole lot of sense.
Yeah, I've kind of almost wonder, and I have no, this is just a theory, I have, of course, we know very little about Pirate Records, but it almost seems like there had to be a reason that they illustrated those characters that way, because they got everything else so right. To have that so blatantly, those two characters so blatantly wrong, I can't imagine that there was some kind of rights issue with George Takei and Nichelle Nichols, because back then they didn't even care about stuff like that. They plastered people on whatever, and that's one reason why they care about them now, is because, hey, you're making tons of money off my face, and I'm not getting anything out of it. So I don't really know what it is, but there almost has to be some kind of weird reason, because unless I'm thinking this was a continuity studios weekend jam job or something, because there does seem to be. I mean, I could just see them passing the pages around, in the continuity studios, the way you kind of, if you've ever, and I know you have, of course, read any history of comics of that time, particularly that studio, that's where Manny Hands and Crusty Bunkers and all those various, we finished up a 24-page comic in a weekend, that type of thing took place. This feels like that. I mean, the artwork's really great, but it varies. I mean, sometimes it looks like Neil Adams. Sometimes it looks like Mike Netzer, maybe, or Gray Morrow or some. I don't know what all it is. There's one picture of Kirk in the book that he kind of looks like a Gray Morrow Kirk to me. So it's really strange, but it's really well done, but it's kind of jarring at times, because it does jump around from style to style, but it all kind of has that Neil Adams like feel to it. So that kind of pulls it together.
Yeah. It does vary from sort of photorealistic, and then other panels are very cartoony. So yeah, it does have that. If there was an anchor, it would be definitely that M. Hands credit that you've seen in 1,000 Marvel comics and stuff like that. Power Records got a lot of use out of this. It appeared, story appeared on 5 different records, a book and record LP, which is the one that Chris and I are looking from. And then it appeared on another LP from around that time with 3 other stories. Then it was repurposed for two different 45s with new sleeves that reflected the motion picture outfits. And then it was repurposed a 5th time on an LP with a bunch of other stories for the motion picture. So they, Power Records really got their money's worth out of this story.
Yeah, well, that's kind of their thing. It's interesting, I didn't even know a lot of those motion picture releases existed until you started posting them recently on the blog. So it's really, I'm sure they didn't bother redrawing their uniforms in the comic. I'm sure that's what you see is what you get. Yeah. But if it did come with a comic, let's talk about the voices. I liked the only voice that was off for me was the renderer of the ship. That voice was really grating.
Yes, it
took a little getting used to. Yeah.
I am sure that's the same guy.
I know they were going for Alien, but
I'm sure that's the same guy who played Mix as Piddalick or the Superman records.
Probably so. Yeah, equally annoying. Yeah, definitely. I did think it was the best line in that story, and perhaps the whole album, is "Die, social misfit."
Yeah. How many times have I heard that in my life?
That just like jumped out at me. I think we can all of us geeks can, we've all heard that before, right?
Heard that in one day.
I was going to say the Dre and the Nax, I couldn't help but think they kept saying Dre. I just wondered if this war didn't actually start with an East Coast, West Coast rap war in the 90s. And Dre obviously won because he got to make the cool headphones that everybody wants nowadays, but that's just me. I don't know. And we know rappers love Power Records, so. Yeah.
That's true. That is true. We do know that. One final thing we will mention before we move on. And it meant, this is on a site that I visited called Star Trek Story Records. The address is danhausertrek.com. I'll put the link in the show notes. It mentions that this plot is very similar to a second season Star Trek Voyager episode, Prototype. In that episode, the Voyager crew encountered a ship crewed by Pralor robotic units who were fighting a long-term war with ships manned by Kravik robotic units. The organic flesh and blood creators of the Prowler and Kravik robotic units had died centuries before. So this plot actually did get repurposed for a later Star Trek show. I mean, I gave up on Voyager. I gave up on Star Trek long before Voyager got into its second season, so I never saw this one. But that's interesting. I wonder if some Star Trek writer happened to own this.
Maybe, yeah. That kind of rings a bell now that you said that, because Voyager was like one of the few things on in our college town. Mm-hmm. So we watched it despite having, you know, the ideas to the contrary. It was just on. But, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, they definitely – well, look, the first season of Next Generation is nothing but recycled plots from the abandoned Star Trek Phase 2 series. So why not, right?
That's true. Yeah. So, okay, well, we're going to wrap that up for A Mirror for Futility, and now we're going to move on to the second audio adventure in this LP set. It's called The Time Stealer, and basically it's Star Trek meets Conan the Barbarian, so go ahead and have a listen.
Captain's log, stardate 6134.6. The mysterious time slowdown we're experiencing has affected not only every crew member on board, but all the Enterprise's instruments and computer banks. It's as if time itself were winding down, and us with it.
Sensor readings confirm my hypothesis, Captain. The slowdown phenomena did not initiate until we came within 3 light years of that peculiar high-density energy field directly ahead.
Shut down all warp engines, Mr. Sulu. I want zero acceleration. Stand by on impulse power.
Shutting down engines now, Captain.
Spock.
Fascinating. The time slowdown seems to have leveled itself the moment we stopped approaching the energy field. For the moment, at least, things are getting no slower.
That's all I wanted to know. Mr. Chekhov, bring us around to 134.8 degrees on full impulse power. I want to put at least 10 light years between us and that energy field.
Aye, sir.
As soon as we began moving in another direction, the slowdown effect started reversing itself, and in moments the crew and the instruments aboard the Enterprise were back to normal, just in time to face a problem of a different nature.
Alien vessel moving along our starboard at warp 3, Captain.
Very well, Mr. Sulu. Shift over to warp 1 and remain on this course. Lieutenant Uhura, open all hailing frequencies.
I'm trying, sir.
Let's see what our shadow looks like. Activate the screen.
Screen on, Captain.
What do you make of it, Spock?
Curious. Although I'm not familiar with the design of the vessel, I would most certainly say those markings on its hull suggest we're being flanked by a warship.
Message from the alien craft coming through now, sir.
Attention, enemy unit. This is Conrak speaking. Surrender your vessel at once or face annihilation. You do not have long to decide.
End of transmission, sir.
What was that you were saying about a warship, Spock?
Perhaps this other ship believes we are responsible for the time slowdown. That would certainly explain their hostility.
They certainly don't feel like explaining it. Damage report.
One of our shields is buckling. Moderate casualties in decks 35 to 38. Warp engines holding steady.
Arm photon torpedoes, Mr. Chekhov.
Photon torpedoes armed and ready, sir.
Very well. Bring us about to 25.5 degrees, Mr. Sulu, and we'll be in position to...
A moment, Captain. Something strange on my sensors.
Report, Spock.
Although the dimensions of their warship are even larger than the Enterprise, sensors indicate only two beings aboard.
Two? Is that possible?
Possible or not, it is a fact, Captain. I would suggest it might be wiser to...
I'm way ahead of you, Spock. Transporter room. Scotty, are you still there?
Aye, Captain. I just finished repairing her.
Fine. Scotty, I want you to lock on to two life forms aboard that alien ship. Spock is feeding the coordinates to you now.
Aye, Captain. The figures are coming over loud and clear. I'm activating the transporter now.
Be careful, Scotty. Spock and I are on our way. A moment later, two shimmering figures appeared in the transporter dock. The one who called himself Conrak turned out to be a fearsome-looking barbaric warrior wielding a double-edged battle-axe. Alongside him was his consort, a much smaller being whose manner of attire made him look like just what he was, a sorcerer. But by the time Spock and I reached the transporter room, Conrak had already destroyed half of it. Scotty was slumped in a corner, his body bruised and battered, and it quickly became apparent Conrak had me marked for the same treatment.
Captain, look out!
Using all the advanced fighting techniques at my command, the best I could do was just stay alive. Conrak's strength was frightening. If any one of his blows connected at its full force, I was done for. But Spock had observed what I was far too busy to notice. All during the fight, Conrak's consort stood absolutely still, his hands rubbing his temples methodically, almost as if he were casting a spell. Acting on pure logic, Spock made an assumption, and he was right. Suddenly, the course of the battle changed. Conrak's unbelievable strength was quickly reduced to the level of a normal man. Now I had the advantage and the superior fighting skills.
You have done the impossible. You have beaten me, Captain Kirk.
Not so impossible, actually. I simply applied a Vulcan nerve pinch to your consort and caused him to pass out.
Spock, I suppose I should say thank you, but I don't understand. Everything didn't become clear until we gathered in sickbay a few minutes later, and Dr. McCoy finished examining our pair of invaders. You want to repeat what you just said, Bones?
It was very simple, Jim. The little fella...
The name is Klee.
Sorry, friend. Klee here is an honest-to-goodness sorcerer, to put it bluntly. The peculiar power running through his body defies all analysis. For lack of a better word, I'd have to call the end product of these collective energies inside him magic.
Magic?
I conjectured something of that nature during your fight with Conrak, Captain. It seems Klee was casting a magic spell to give Conrak an incredible degree of strength.
Up until now, Conrak had remained somber and silent, but that was before a report from the bridge came over the intercom.
Sulu here, Captain. You told me to report any change in the status of the time slowdown area.
Yes, Sulu.
Well, sir, it's moved. A full 3,000 kilometers since our first sighting of it.
Fascinating.
Yes, it moves. It has its own orbit.
Conrak, tell us what you know about this thing.
Our people call it the Gola. And its far-flung orbit through this part of the galaxy brings it in range of our planet at regular intervals. A more terrible fate for any world I could not imagine.
I don't get it. Just what does this Gola do?
Think about it, Doctor. You saw what the time slowdown did to us in just a brief interval. Now imagine an entire planet caught in its stagnating influence for centuries at a time.
Now I see. Scientific progress, cultural advances, even your people's thinking processes, it would all slow down to a crawl.
Correct, Captain. Klee tells me our civilization is the same age as yours. Yet while your people explore the galaxy in starships, mine are still dressed as barbarians.
But your warship...
Conceived and powered by sorcery, McCoy. Not science.
If it weren't for Klee's wizardry, we could never have attempted this mission.
You came to destroy the Gola.
By any means we could, even if it meant sacrificing ourselves. I wrongly made the assumption your vessel was controlling the Gola. And for the attack, I am truly sorry.
Captain's log supplemental. Conrak and Klee were sincere. Their entire race was counting on them to wipe out the menace that had held their culture locked in a standstill for centuries. And now they had the help of a starship.
Phasers armed and ready, Chekhov?
Armed and ready, sir. Let's hope they do more good against the Gola than the photon torpedoes just did.
Fire!
Three direct hits, but sensors show absolutely no effect.
Your weapons are formidable, Kirk. but the Gola seems to know no weakness.
Incredible. Conjecture, Spock?
I may just be an old country doctor myself, but I'd say the Gola was warping time all around him, making our phasers and photons detonate either in the past or future instead of the here and now.
I'm impressed, Doctor. For a mind of your caliber, that is an amazingly accurate assessment.
Spock, you can take your Vulcan mind.
Gentlemen,
and...
I suggest we concentrate on the disturbance at hand.
Not merely a disturbance, Captain. It is now an enemy.
Spock, what are you saying?
The Gola is now coming directly toward us. We attacked, and now it's retaliating. That, I maintain, is an irrefutable indication of intelligence. The Gola is a living entity.
Well, I'll be...
As usual, Spock's logic was faultless and absolutely correct. But this revelation changed our situation dramatically. We were now up against a foe with some sort of mind. Could that fact work for us or against us? We just didn't know. But Spock and Klee were up to something, finally coming out of a huddle at the far end of the bridge.
Captain, Klee and I have conceived a possible means of combating this creature.
Through its mind, Captain Kirk. Spock says he can electronically transmit mental energy into space through your sensors.
But even if that's true, Spock, how could any of our minds possibly be a match for anything so vast and limitless?
A point well taken, Doctor. But a single mind is not the ammunition we're speaking of.
Spock thinks our one chance is to attack the Gola not with an individual, but a whole culture.
Explain, Spock.
A composite burst of mental energy, Captain, composed of all the minds of every member of Klee's race down through the ages. The melding of millions of minds into one concentrated channel.
Spock, you're space happy if you believe that's even conceivable, let alone possible.
On the contrary, Doctor. It may be impossible in terms of science, but we're not talking about using science here.
Magic.
Exactly, Captain. I've already shown Klee how to use our computer banks as a storehouse for the millions of mental images he will be conjuring up.
I suggest we back away from my consort now and give him room.
Conrak was accustomed to seeing Klee's wizardry, but we were not. As his magic drew upon the mind streams of millions of his ancestors, the rest of us stood back in awe.
It's fantastic, Spock. I would never have thought such a thing possible.
Just how old is your culture, Conrak? How much further does Klee's magic have to reach?
The exact date of our origin is unknown. We do know our oldest ancestors came from a far-off planet many eons ago. A planet called Earth.
All of us share the same look of amazement. Earth, he said. Could Conrak and Klee be from our very own planet? Before we could explore the topic further, however...
The Gola is still advancing and closing fast, sir.
Klee!
He's ready, Captain. The counterattack will begin now.
Klee's hands were gripped around the terminals of the sensor panel. His entire body was surrounded by a shimmering aura as he transmitted an incalculable energy charge through space... Composed of millions of separate mental bursts, the sum total force of Klee's entire culture down through the ages.
Report, Sulu. The Gola's charge is slowing, but it isn't stopping him, sir. He's still coming.
In heaven's name, it's not enough. It's just not enough.
I am afraid our race was not old enough, Captain. Our culture's history has not amassed enough mind power to overcome the Gola's sheer mental strength.
Spock! What the blazes is he doing?
He's grabbing the terminals of the sensor panel.
He is glowing with the same shimmering aura that enveloped Klee.
Oh, my God. I understand.
We all did. Spock was picking up where Klee left off, using what was left of the magic spell to force feed his culture into the sensors.
I admire your first officer's courage, Kirk. But how can he hope to succeed where my consort failed?
The Vulcan race is one of the oldest in the galaxy, Conrak. Odds are it's far older than your race or ours.
That's right, now that I think of it. Vulcan history goes back so far, Spock will have billions of more mind streams to draw from.
Look, I think Spock's reached his limit.
He must stop. Too much mental energy will kill him.
Then it happened. All at once, Spock released the sum total of Vulcan mental energy amassed through millions of years, transmitted through our sensors in one massive charge. And although the invisible charge did not show up on our screens, the result did.
Look! Spock's done it! The Gola is backing away! It's trying to flee, but it's slowing down!
I believe that last energy burst paralyzed it.
That is correct, Conrad.
Conrad.
Spock, you're all right?
Somewhat exhausted, but feeling satisfactory, Captain. And you, Klee?
I'm fine. Now that I know we've finally beaten the scourge of our race.
Now that we've got the Gola where we want it, what do we do with the blasted thing?
I am addressing that problem at this very moment, Doctor.
Explain, Spock.
In transmitting that mental burst to the Gola, I came in contact with its mental center, Captain. What we would call its mind. I have just completed a circuit that will allow all of us to hear what it is thinking at this moment.
Incredible.
I never could have guessed such a thing.
Spock, that sounds like the crying of a baby.
Very astute, Doctor. Gentlemen, Gola is a mere infant. Not a baby in the human sense of the word, but a baby nevertheless. It was spawned in the heart of a star sun millions of light years away, and its far-reaching orbit has really been a methodical search for its parent.
The sun that spawned it!
Yes, Conrack. The fearsome menace your people dreaded is merely a child lost in the stars. Our job now is to locate its home.
Captain's log, stardate 6453.2. After using a long-range tractor beam to pull Gola behind us for several days, we finally released it moments ago. As we orbited the star sun, Spock's calculations had pinpointed as the parent. All of us watched the screen in eager anticipation.
Instruments show the Gola is now stationary in the core of the star sun, Captain.
Thank you, Mr. Sulu. I think it's safe to say the baby is home.
Well, Spock, I've got to hand it to you. As a galactic babysitter, you're not half bad. See you all later.
Spock, about Conrack and Klee, something bothers me.
Captain, we return them to their home planet. With Gola gone, they'll begin to progress normally now. I don't see a problem.
That part about them coming from a planet called Earth, I can't help wondering if it was our Earth. But there are no historical records of an ancient civilization vanishing from Earth that long ago.
Curious. When I took over from Klee at the Sensors, I picked up brief mental images of his very first ancestors. They were evacuating a sinking continent in spaceships.
Spock!
Tell me, Captain, isn't there an old Earth legend about a civilization that sank beneath the sea called Atlantis?
Atlantis? Mr. Spock, would you be surprised if you just solved one of the greatest mysteries on Earth of all time?
Surprised? Hardly, Captain. Somewhat pleased, perhaps.
Spock, never mind.
And that was The Time Stealer. There's a whole lot to say about this adventure, but really the main takeaway is this story is essentially the crew of the Enterprise meets Conan the Barbarian.
Yeah. And when it looks like it's drawn by John Buscema, then yeah, it really looks like it's
yeah. I mean, if you look at the book and record, some pages of which we'll include on the Tumblr, which is fireandwaterpodcast.tumblr.com, they even have some panels look like it was drawn by John Buscema. I mean, it's clearly not John Buscema doing it, because I don't think he ever did any work for the Power Records, but I think it's somebody at Continuity Studios aping John Buscema. I mean, it's so obvious, I'm almost kind of amazed they got away with it.
Yeah. John Buscema did do, around that time, I know he did do some of the Big Jim packaging, like Kirby did some, and then he did some, like Big Jim's pack. So maybe, you know, who knows, maybe he farmed out a little bit at the time. And that was around the same time, but I know that's kind of a leap from Mattel to Power Records, but you never know, you know.
No, that's true. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, so
yeah, I mean, I had never seen this book and record set. I never had this one as a kid, and I'd only seen panels here and there. And every time I would see it, I was like, "My God, that looks just like Conan!" I couldn't believe it, you know. And then, yeah, I mean, in the story, he's called Conrack. So yeah. I mean, they're really not trying to hide it at all.
No. I mean, it's yeah. They're definitely yeah. This is Conan on Star Trek. Definitely.
Yeah. And that would have been amazing. I mean, it would have been a crossover nobody could ever have done. I mean, it would have been fun to do in the comics, because at one point, of course, Marvel had the rights to the Star Trek comic. And, of course, they had Conan.
Yeah.
So they could have done it, I guess, if they really wanted to, you know, be cute.
It took me a while to figure out that Conan wasn't owned by Marvel because they put him on, like, everything. If you saw an ad with a bunch of Marvel characters, he was in it. He was on the Mego Conan was on the Marvel packaging, you know, with their characters. And so it wouldn't surprise me, you know, if anybody balked at it back then, it probably would have been Paramount, not the estate of Robert E. Howard. So, you know, it would have been kind of cool to see. Of course, you know, it would have been the pajama Trek crew, like we said.
But yeah.
It still would have been Trek, so.
Yeah, I mean, Conan appeared in their subscription ads, and he was in an issue of What If. So, you know, yeah, it did seem like he was just, I was like you. I don't think I knew that he was a separate character. And when the Conan movie came out, I considered that like a Marvel Comics movie. I didn't think about that. It really had no connection to it.
Yeah, that's, well, I'm sure back then they'd like to count it as such.
Yeah. the beginnings of the Marvel movie universe.
There you go.
Yeah.
Oh, I just want to point out, I loved it when Kirk said something about his advanced fighting techniques. You know, those include that famous shoulder roll, the two-fisted swing to the stomach, the karate chop to the neck, and then the infamous deadly double feet leap kick, you know, when he falls on the ground after he kicks. The guy's got a battle axe, you know.
Yeah.
I think the Klee guy is the same voice as the renderer from the previous story.
Yes.
Which,
yeah.
Ooh,
yeah.
You know, it's kind of this jumped out at me, you know, as a Star Trek fan. They beam over Conrad, right? Yeah,
Conrad,
and Klee to the Enterprise. And I know most of the ships that they meet usually are obviously more manned, but why didn't they ever think of that before? Maybe they couldn't because of shields, but if they could pull the captain and and the guy firing the phasers off the ship with the transporter, that would have made a lot of Star Trek episodes end a lot quicker. You know,
yeah, they ended up having that technology on Next Gen, of course, where they could like literally beam just one person off of things, but. Yeah, you're right. It's like the end of the Kirk would have had a much easier time if they could have used the teleporter that specifically.
Right. Yeah. That kind of jumped out at me. It's like, hey, that's actually kind of a neat idea. That's the thing I like about these, that they actually, that's one reason why they feel like Trek is whoever wrote this was thinking in Trek mode. They didn't just throw together an audio adventure that used the characters' names, you know, Like I know you posted that on the blog recently, that Ghostbusters record that was, you know, from the 80s, you know, based on the Ghostbusters movie. That was entirely the type of kids out storybook record that you would expect, where they just licensed the names, the characters, and the writer didn't put any thought into actually making it work within that universe.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
This whoever wrote this knew Star Trek, because it, even though you've got a barbarian and a sorcerer, and you kind of think, well, that's kind of out there. Then you got to stop and think, well, the Enterprise crew met Paolo, they met Space Lincoln, you know?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
This isn't quite as far-fetched as you think at first. So I just was really impressed with both of these. I do have to point out, though, that when you get to the reveal of what Gola looks like, I think all they needed to defeat him was a big bag of lime, because he looks like Starro the Conqueror.
Yes, that's true.
Or Snapper Carr when you need it.
Come on, Chris.
Put him in a red shirt.
Well, that's true. Yeah. Man, yeah, I would agree with that. Yeah, just putting Snapper Carr and beaming him into space, I'd be all right with that. So, yeah.
All right. In the cold vacuum of space. I did want to point out one more thing that I thought kind of jumped out at me. They kept using the term, they kept calling Klee the consort of Conrak. And I'm thinking the whole time, I'm kind of like Inigo Montoya. I'm like, I don't think that word means what you think it means. I looked up consort. It says a wife, husband, or companion, in particular, the spouse of a reigning monarch. So this was very progressive for Conrak, in the 70s.
Well, this is the future, Chris. I mean, come on. I mean, you know. This
well,
is
that's right. They might have lived in a stagnant culture, but it wasn't too stagnant.
No,
because,
right.
You know, hey,
yes.
You know.
Absolutely. Yes. Thank goodness marriage equality has reached the 23rd century.
I was going to say, what did you think about the reveal? It ties into your your shtick, man. Where they come from.
Well, yeah. I mean, it was all right. I mean, it's a little like, all right, Atlantis. Come on, you know. I mean, it's, you know, like, it just felt like one extra crazy thing to throw in at the end. But it was, I liked it. I thought it was just a cute reference. You know, I mean, it's you know, I mean, it was. I don't know. I didn't think that much about it. Okay. I was just like, okay, it was Atlantis. Yeah, that's fine.
See, I've got to quit overthinking these things when I listen to these things for the show. I'm thinking, ha, it's the Aquaman connection, you know?
Yeah, I was like, eh, all right. Yeah, it's Atlantis. It's fine. So
I'm just grasping at straws at this point, I think.
I think the Power Records people appreciate the level of thought you put into these.
Yeah, I'm sure they do.
So the Time Stealer appeared on 7 different Power Records. It was repurposed with the gray pajama sets several times. It was given its own 45 with a brand new Neil Adams cover, which makes him look even more like Conan, because he's got like this, he looks like King Conan on there, and he's chopping at Kirk and Spock with his axe. Plus, it appeared on this book and record set, and then of LP. So again, this was another very popular. I mean, who knows how Power Records figured out which ones were popular? It was probably more down to about running time or something like that. But this one got repurposed quite a bit. So you know, again, another. Uh-huh. They really got their money's worth.
Yeah, they. I mean, this one. You know, and I'm sure this one they could sell as, you know, to you know, across several different fan bases, you know, with the Barbarian. So, I mean, you know, it's kind of the adventure part of it jumps out at you more than the first one, which was, you know, more of a thinking man's Trek episode, whereas this is one of the, you know, wild fun ones. So, you know, I could definitely see the appeal of this one. I mean, who doesn't like a, you know, a Barbarian? Plus, I'm sure Kirk got his shirt ripped, you know, which is...
Everybody loves that.
Everybody loves it, you know, yeah. So...
Yeah. So, so that was The Time Stealer and Mirror for Futility, two really solid Star Trek adventures. Before we move on to listener feedback, Chris and I wanted to take a moment just to mention Leonard Nimoy. Because when Leonard Nimoy passed away a couple of months ago, it was like, I think it was a week that Shag and I were doing a Who's Who, and it just wasn't like appropriate to bring it up. But I wanted to mention it because Leonard Nimoy was huge in any geek's life. Leonard Nimoy looms large. He was, you know, in many ways, the face of Star Trek. I grew up with him just as much as the host of In Search Of in the 70s. I love that show. I mean, because when you're a kid, you know, like you're into that stuff, like Bigfoot and UFOs and the Loch Ness Monster. And, you know, he just seemed always like such a really gentle guy. He had a good sense of humor about himself. And just, I don't know. I think it's like he comes with all the warmth that you get from Star Trek. Without kind of the downside of William Shatner, who you've heard like a lot of bad things about. Well, you know what I mean? It's like there's lots of bad stories about Shatner that you can choose to believe or not choose to believe. I'm sure some of them are true. I mean, he's a person like anybody else. But like Leonard Nimoy is like uniformly liked by everybody. And there's kind of a nice thing about that. And so when he passed away, it really felt like a large, you know, I don't want to say like a void, but it was sad when it dawned on me that that Star Trek Into Darkness would be the last time we'd ever see him.
Yeah,
that's it. You know, and he was planned to be in the next film. I guess they're going to have to rewrite all that. But it just, you know, he seemed like a really, really great guy. And you know, when you think of Star Trek, you can't help but think of Spock.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, I think part of that. I think it's one of those cases where the character and the actor. You know, you like them both. Because of what you knew of Nimoy, you know, he was somebody from what we know of him that it's not like we knew him, but from what we know of him, he was, you know, like you said, he seemed like a gentle guy, but he also was somebody who stood firm and what he believed in, you know, was good craft. You know, he stood up when he thought they were dumbing down Star Trek in season 3. He took a lot of flack, you know, he kind of pushed back against it. And, you know, and he always kind of, he wanted Star Trek to be of good quality. He didn't want it to degenerate into a kid sci-fi show, you know. And then, you know, you got to see him on other things. And like you, I grew up, I knew him from In Search Of before I knew him from Trek. And I had a Mego Spock figure and had no idea who he was. But because a neighbor gave them to me. But, you know, I think at some point I figured out, oh, this is the guy from In Search Of. I haven't
asked him
to think of it. And then at some point later, I got into – my dad got me into Star Trek finally after trying for years. But, you know, and I think, you know, of course, Spock, you know, all – it's been said to death and we're not saying anything new. But, you know, Spock represents the outsider. And, you know, as people who like what we like, we've all felt that at some point. And then, of course, all sorts of other groups can identify with that. And, you know, and because of his personality off camera – that just made him that much more endearing. And it really bothered me a lot more than I even thought it would for like a week. You know, I was just like kind of in the dumps about it. And it's like, it really, it's like, wow, this really affects me more than I perceived as a, you know, as a kind of an older, slightly more cynical person that it still, you know, kind of got to me, you know, but he definitely left behind a body of work that will endure and, you know, what else can you say, you know?
Yeah. I mean, creatively he was responsible. He directed Star Trek IV, which is my favorite piece of Star Trek of everything, of the show, of the, all the shows, all the movies, not only Star Trek IV, my favorite of the Trek movies, is one of my all time favorite movies, period. And it was, you know, he shepherded that movie and he brought a, you know, a lightness to it and a humanity that I think a lot of the other Star Trek didn't have. So, yeah, it's a giant, giant loss. And, you know, we were all sort of better off for having been around when he was around. He seemed like a great guy. So we are going to now wrap up with listener feedback that we got for the previous episode, which was the Batman episode. So, Chris, do you want to start?
Yeah, our buddy Count Druncula, a.k.a. Ryan Daly, wrote, "Sarcastic claps. Thanks a lot, guys. This episode completely ruined my Sunday. Why? Because I'll never get a Batman Sherlock TV movie starring Adam West, Peter Cushing, and Vincent Price. Way to inflate my balloon and then bust it, Chris." Well, you're welcome, Ryan.
We got a message from Ange, and he said, "Gorilla City was a hoot. I was wondering why they made such a big deal of the meditation in the beginning. Should have known it would come into play later. And Batman kind of gets the crap kicked out of him in this story. In particular, the grunting we hear at the end of Grodd is crushing. When Grodd is crushing Batman is pretty disturbing. Had to look up the WF cover by Buckler. Never saw that one before." Yeah, it's the sound effects in that one are really quite memorable. Batman getting snapped and doing that slow talky thing, and it's really, really quite effective.
Don't do that.
Yeah. That's never left my brain ever since I was 8 years old.
Speaking of slow talky thing, I forgot to mention this, and I should have when we were talking about the time stealers. When I was doing the dishes when I was listening to that, and Cindy walked through, and it was during the part where everything was slowed down Kirk was talking slow. And she said, "How does Kirk sound any different?" I was like, you're really right. He goes on to, Ange goes on to say, "Scarecrow Corpse was fun as well. Those are some rough British accents. Sounds like me trying to imitate Austin Powers. Some of it is incomprehensible. The mystery of Holmes is a nice touch." Yeah, those accents, when I was a kid, until I got the comic, I had no idea what the heck they were saying.
Yeah.
Had no idea. We got a message from Kyle Benning, he says, he's talking about the Power Records, the Batman episode. And he said, "And then there's Batman. His voice just didn't fit for me. I know Power Records used the same handful of voice actors over and over again, but his generic superhero voice just didn't do it for me. Maybe it's just because Kevin Conroy's voice is so ingrained in my head as being the voice of Batman, but this guy just seemed off. I assume when this came out, the 66 Batman series would have already been in syndication, so you have that iconic Adam West voice as Batman of the time ingrained in the mind of youngsters. So I wondered if kids that picked this Power Record up at the time it was released found the voice to be off a bit as well. Or do they just not care since it was Batman and therefore awesome?" I could kind of answer that because, yes, Batman was 66 Batman series was in very heavy syndication at the time. And when I picked this album up, well, I didn't have this particular – I had the stories on this album. I had them on a different album. But I actually liked this Batman voice. To me, he had enough of that deep, heroic sound that it wasn't off to me. There's another Batman actor on was it the Joker one, the Stacked Cards,
yeah.
Yeah, I don't particularly like that guy. And when I first heard that one, I felt that was off. But this guy I like, so that didn't, and I totally agree. You know, now I can't read a Batman story without hearing Kevin Conroy in my head. It worked for, as a 70s kid that picked this up, it worked for me at the time, and I guess it sounded enough in the vein of Adam West that it didn't scream no to me, so there you go.
There you go. We got a message from Tim Wallace. He says, I love Sherlock Holmes, and I'm a sucker for any reference to him. But after listening to both stories, I was left with one burning question. What is VIP treatment in Gorilla City? Bananas on your pillow at turndown? Considering what we know about Gorilla City via the Jeff Parker issues of Aquaman, I have to assume the VIP treatment is not getting your brain eaten by the gorillas, Tim. So it's a rough place.
and then
finally on the Power Records blog, which is powerrecord.blogspot.com, Rockwell J. Pugglesworth, I doubt that's his real name, said Batman and Scooby-Doo and the Mystery of the Scarecrow Corpse would have strangely been right up Power Records Demented Alley. And Chris, you also blew my mind with your pitch-perfect dream casting of Christopher Lee as Ra's al Ghul. I hope that actually happened in an alternate universe.
Me too.
Yeah, I
paid money to see that. Yeah,
would have been really, really good. So that's it. That's going to do it for this episode of the Power Records podcast. Chris, where can people find you on the interwebs?
Well, my wife Cindy and I host the Supermates podcast. You can find that on iTunes or go to supermatescomic.blogspot.com.
Awesome. It's one of my favorite shows. Everybody should listen to it if you're not already. And like I said, please listen to the regular Fire and Water podcast on the Fire and Water feed and all the other shows we've got going on there. You can shoot us an email at firewaterpodcast@comcast.net. You can find images from this Power Record set on the Tumblr, which is fireandwaterpodcast.tumblr.com. So thanks for listening. Until the next episode, drop the needle and turn the page.
Come, Robin. Into the Batmobile and home.
My work is done here.
What do you mean your work is done? You didn't do anything.
Didn't I?